Part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. Millions of years ago, a rock from Mars was sent hurtling into space when a giant asteroid or comet crashed into that planet. The rock from the red planet had a long trip through space before it crashed into the Earth. That was about 13,000 years ago. It landed in the Antarctic, where it remained until 1984. On the program today, we'll hear about this rock and the contentious scientific debate that grew up around it. Did the meteorite once harbor Martian bacteria? Had there been life on Mars? Our guest this afternoon is science journalist Kathy Sawyer. She is the author of The Rock from Mars, a detective story on two planets. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions and comments. I look forward to your telephone calls. The numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Kathy Sawyer has been nominated twice for the Pulitzer Prize. She covered the space, science, and technology beat for the Washington Post for 17 years. Her work has also appeared in magazines such as National Geographic and Astronomy. Her book, The Rock from Mars, a detective story on two planets, is published by Random House. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Kathy Sawyer, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Good afternoon, Celeste. It's great to be with you.
Yeah. What do we know? Do we know much at all about what happened on Mars when that asteroid or comet slammed into the planet?
We don't know very much because it happened so long ago, but some scientists in California have made an effort to study the craters on Mars, and they've selected some candidates that might have been the site from which this rock was blasted loose.
Hmm. What was life on Earth like when that meteorite that would come to be known as our rock star, our ALH84001, landed?
Well, it's the rock itself has a very complex history. It's the oldest known rock from any planet. It's 4.5 billion years old. The signs that it might have contained life have been dated from about 3.6 billion years ago, and that's about the same time as Earth was first forming its first life. And so the thinking is that possibly Mars used to be warmer and wetter, very similar to what the young Earth was like, and it somehow in the intervening eons since then has become cold and dry and lifeless. And part of the puzzle of this rock and of all the studies of Mars that are going on now is to figure out what happened. They had quite a big climate change.
Hmm. Interesting. How do you determine where a meteorite comes from? How is it that we know that this particular rock came from Mars?
Well, that was a very good question. The rock, after it was discovered in Antarctica by a young geologist, a woman named Robbie Score, in 1984, it was brought back to the meteorite archives at Johnson Space Center in Houston, and it sat on a shelf for 12 years before anybody realized what it was. They had first classified it as a plain vanilla meteorite from an asteroid, of which we have many, many thousands of such samples on Earth. Then a scientist named Duck Mittelfeldt at the Houston facility started working on an experiment on asteroid-based meteorites, and in the course of his studies discovered that this rock didn't fit in, and it wasn't from an asteroid or a comet. It was from Mars, and it became, at that time, the 12th known Martian meteorite. We now have about 30 that have been found on Earth that we know about, but even among the family of Martian meteorites, this one stands out as weird and unusual. But to answer your question specifically, how did they know it was from Mars? Trapped gases inside one of the rocks from Mars exactly was found to match the atmosphere on Mars, and the reason they knew at all what the atmosphere on Mars was like was because in the mid-1970s, we sent two spacecraft called Voyager not Voyager, that's the wrong mission. We sent two spacecraft called Viking to land on the planet, and they sampled the atmosphere and sent those readings back to Earth in the mid-1970s. Lo and behold, all those decades later, it was that mission played a role in this big controversy that's still going on.
Yeah. Isn't it interesting that this is like history? This is something that we keep revisiting. We keep making advances, and we have to go back and say, well, you know, the theories are challenged, or new information crops up. Or maybe it's new information has been sitting on the shelf for a while, and maybe it's not so new, but the discovery of what is hidden within that nugget is new.
Well, this actually, the research on the rock, once it was known it was from Mars, took quite a new turn, and nobody had ever investigated a rock in the way that this one has been. Once Duck Mittelfeldt discovered that this rock came from Mars, another young scientist, actually not a NASA scientist, but a postdoc working at Johnson Space Center in Houston in the early 90s, decided that it might be a good idea to look for biology in this rock. And the reason he did that was because at the time, a whole revolution was taking place in what people know about life on Earth. Using new instruments and new technologies, scientists were finding out that life, microbial life mostly, could thrive in places previously thought to be lethal to all forms of life, at the bottom of the ocean, around boiling hot vents, inside rock, inside ice in Antarctica, and so on. The studies of this rock took on a larger meaning because the research is really about some of the most fundamental questions about our place in nature. Are we alone? Is there life on other planets? Mm-hmm. Also, how do we even define life? The controversy that has followed this rock got into all sorts of basic questions like that.
Let's talk with a listener. We have a caller waiting to talk with us on line one in Urbana. Good afternoon. You're on the air with Kathy Sawyer. Hello?
Good afternoon.
Hi.
I'm trying to remember whether or not the probe that you described, the one that sampled the atmosphere back in the 70s, also tried to do some surface soil chemistry.
Very good, sir. That's absolutely right. The Viking landers actually were the first optimistic probes sent by NASA to try to find out if there was life on Mars. And they didn't succeed in finding anything. They sent back some analysis that was very provocative, and people got their hopes up, but then after some further analysis, they decided it was partly because we had introduced unfamiliar chemistry onto Mars. In any case, the scientific consensus after the Viking missions was that they had failed to detect signs of even of organics on Mars, much less signs of actual biology. And what turned up in this particular rock from Mars was the first significant amount of organic compounds known to be from Mars.
And the analysis of the sample from Antarctica was presumably from a period that the 1970s probe did not analyze, because the chemistries were too different.
You're referring, to this meteorite, the one that was found in Antarctica. Of course, the Vikings were limited to the selected landing spots where they sat, and this rock was selected at random by nature from whatever site it came from. And so it's, as many people have pointed out, it's very difficult to draw vast conclusions from one small sample of a great big planet. Imagine if you had one sample of rock from the planet Earth, from either from mountains, from desert, from seafloor. It could be from anywhere, and it would tell you completely different things about that planet. So you're absolutely right. These are all very complicated and difficult questions to derive much from in these limited samples.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other questions are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, anywhere else. Toll-free 800-222-9455. This is The Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our guest this afternoon, journalist Kathy Sawyer, author of The Rock from Mars, a detective story on two planets. Can you give us some idea of the organic compounds that are in this particular rock, and is that why it really stands out among the 30 that we have from Mars?
Well, it stands out, first of all, as I say, because of it's the oldest known rock from any planet, including Earth. It dates from the very infancy of the solar system. The specific compounds found in this rock that you're asking about are kind of a tongue-twisting name, polycyclic, aromatic polycyclic. See there?
Yeah.
polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. Please forgive me. I do get tongue-tied.
Not a problem.
And thank goodness we call them PAHs, or PAHs for short. And they are sometimes associated with life, but they can also be found in absolutely lifeless meteorites and lots of other places where they're not associated with life. But the meteorite also contained carbonates, these were round sort of blebs or globules, as they were called. These carbonates are often associated with the detritus from marine organisms on Earth. And so that caught the attention of this young postdoc geochemist at Johnson Space Center, and that's one of the reasons he decided to look further into this to see if there were further clues to biology. And the carbonates had very complex rims, Oreo rims, as they were called, after the cookie, black, white, black, concentric circles, and most of the interesting stuff in this rock that has attracted so much attention and been investigated in so many laboratories is contained in these rims around the carbonate blebs. And there were also little forms that the scientists, the initial claims were that these were fossil-like shapes and might be the fossil remains of extremely microscopically small bacteria or organisms. But one trouble with that was that they were much smaller than bacteria known to exist on Earth.
Hmm. So where do things stand today? What's the latest best thinking about this rock and what it has to say to us?
Many scientists discount the claims that there are signs of biology in this rock, but it's still generating papers. This was one of the angriest debates of the last century for a number of reasons, but in the course of this, I like to call this a good kind of fight, because this is the way science proceeds, and I think this case study of the rock is a great example of how we learn new stuff about our place in nature. The scientists made some really extraordinary claims about this rock, that it might contain signs of the first extraterrestrial life ever discovered. And then other scientists had their chance to shoot at the evidence and try to discount it. Now, these claims have not been disproven, but the burden is on the group of scientists who made the claims to prove their case, and they acknowledge they haven't done that either. So there are still papers being generated from this. There's a meeting coming up in Houston of planetary scientists, and I know of several papers that are going to be papers or abstracts or presentations of some sort on this subject that will be presented there. So what happens is this provocative claim has provoked all sorts of new research, and it has changed thinking on how to define life and impress people with the need to get a better definition of life versus non-life, and more topically, more to the point of the current news, it has changed the thinking of people who plan missions to Mars. And as you may know, we the people of planet Earth have 3 spacecraft in orbit around Mars currently, and 2 robotic geologists prowling the surface, looking for evidence of water and other conditions conducive to life, and they've been finding quite striking clues that there was once water on the planet.
Very interesting.
And which leads me to the point of saying that the next spacecraft is scheduled to arrive at Mars tomorrow, if all goes well. It's on its approach right now.
Has this debate also stepped up efforts on Antarctica by geologists to find other meteorites?
When the claims were first made about this rock in 1996, there hadn't been a lot of study of microbial diversity in Antarctica. Since then, there's been quite a bit. In fact, not just because of this rock, but Antarctica is a real scientifically oriented continent, if you will. Lots of different kinds of science go on there, and it's really thanks to a group of international treaties, scientists can use Antarctica without interfering with any civilization that might be there. The nations of the world have agreed to peacefully share Antarctica, much of it for in the name of various kinds of science, from astronomy to microbiology and lots of things in between. They're examining a body of water there for weird kinds of life that would break new ground. So it's a hotbed of scientific activity.
How do they share their wealth, if you will?
I'm sorry?
How do they share the wealth? For example, when Robbie Skor and the members of that expedition picked up their rocks and went home, those rocks went to NASA's Johnson Space Center. what kind of cooperation goes on Antarctica and then after Antarctica between scientists from around the world?
Well, this rock is in many, many pieces now. There's an interagency committee that allocates pieces, samples from this rock to interested scientists. After it left Antarctica, it went to this lab in Houston where lots and lots of space rocks reside, including the ones brought back by the Apollo astronauts from the moon. And these samples of this rock and the others are allocated to interested scientists who have submitted proposals for studies to be done. And so this rock has been studied by tons of the most advanced equipment on Earth and by many hundreds of scientists around the world.
Why does Antarctica provide such a good opportunity for finding space rocks? And maybe here you would talk with us about the meteorite conveyor belt.
Yes. The Antarctic has a special mechanism that uses natural forces, the screaming, howling cold winds, and the motion of the glacial motion of the ice downslope toward the sea. All of this combines to, in effect, isolate and strand great numbers of meteorites on the surface in what's called stranding fields. These meteorites fall on Antarctic no greater rate than they fall on any other part of the Earth. But because of this mechanism and because of the ice is dazzling and clear, people are able to go down in teams and mount grid searches, sort of like a crime scene investigation. They bring these rocks, they find these rocks lying on the surface where, because of the combined action of the winds and other forces, they're brought up from below as the glacial ice sort of shoulders up against certain mountains that get in the way of this flow toward the sea. They're trapped there, and then the wind scours the ice, and other effects happen, the rock comes to the surface and stays there to be picked up by curious humans.
And how are the rocks then treated from that point on? Do they have to be specially handled?
Oh, very specially handled. They're put into sanitary containers, and contamination is a huge concern. And so they handle them, label them, record where they're found, and so forth. And they try to avoid everything from earth microbes to nose drips from the scientists from getting anywhere near them once they're found. Of course, this rock was lying in the Antarctic ice for some 13,000 years before it was found. So they had to do a lot of careful study after the rock was found and brought to the laboratory in Houston. A lot of the studies were geared to showing which stuff in the rock came from Earth and which stuff was indigenous to its Martian origins.
There is a fellow in the story who's a geochemist. His name is David McKay, and he went to work for NASA back in the 1960s, where he would help train astronauts, in the Apollo program. Talk with us about the role he played in the investigation of the rocks that came back from Antarctica, and maybe you can give us a sense of how this field of otherworldly rocks, as the study of otherworldly rocks, has progressed over the years since the days of the Apollo program.
Well, David McKay was a young geologist, geochemist, and who joined NASA at the heyday of the Apollo program, but it was not a given at that time that there would even be any science connected with the missions. It was a Cold War instrument. It was mainly to beat the Russians and show that our way of life was better than theirs. And so the scientists had to kind of kick and scream to get their experiments included and their geological collection put on the manifest. So David McKay was one of the young scientists who helped train Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin to collect rocks on the first moon landing. And he devoted much of his career to studying the results of those missions, the lunar samples. And he studied a specific aspect of these rocks, dust, lunar surface dust. And so he had a long career of studying space rocks, and he was branching into cosmic dust, and then he at some point got really sick and tired of studying lunar dust, for heaven's sake. He wanted a little bit of variety, so he was casting about for something more interesting, and the young postdoc in his lab, Chris Romanek, and another colleague, Everett Gibson, and he started to focus their attention on this very intriguing rock, which really stood out among all the rocks in the collection. And the rest is what has been in all the headlines and the subject of press conferences and so forth.
Yeah. What was it that first got them excited? What was the one thing that first they said, this is something, we've got something here?
Well, they saw signs of what resembled on controversial little shapes on Earth found in hot springs that had been called nanofossils. That's extremely, extremely small fossil bacteria or fossil microbes. And I think I mentioned that there was reason to believe that microbes could thrive in very harsh conditions previously thought to be lethal to life. And so with the awareness of these new discoveries about the hardiness of life, the scientists in Houston started looking at this rock with new, more powerful instruments and at much higher magnification, and they were struck by the not just the individual lines of evidence like the fossil shapes and the carbon compounds and so forth, but by the way they were grouped inside the rock. They thought because of the properties, the geochemical properties, that this stuff wouldn't all be together in one place, except with some sort of living organism as a mediating bridge, so to speak, something that made things happen along the boundaries. And they were so amazed by their own thinking that they decided to keep it very secret and not tell anybody until they had better evidence.
When and how was it revealed that this rock could offer evidence of past life on Mars?
Well, the big coming out was in 1996 in August, and it didn't happen the way anybody planned. They had gone through all sorts of preparations for a major press conference, and they had the scientists had passed peer review, that is, an independent review by outside scientists, and been approved for publication of their claims in the very respected journal Science. And they were, the scientists from Houston were called to NASA headquarters for a grilling a three-hour grilling by the NASA administrator who wanted to make sure that their claims would stand up to scrutiny before he put the reputation of NASA behind it. And there was also the need to tell the president. It was a presidential election year, and President Clinton was running for re-election, and there were political considerations that had to be handled and dealt with, and so on. But in the end, all of the preparations went into a cocked hat because the word got out. A very interested trade reporter named Leonard David had been digging around at meetings and hearing rumors about this meteorite that might have life in it, and he put a little blurb in his trade publication that mentioned this work, and that sort of opened the floodgates. And I was sitting in the newsroom at the Washington Post on one Tuesday in August 1996, and I started getting phone calls, and there was a wire report, and people were saying NASA scientists were about to claim they might have found clues of life on Mars. And at this point, all the plans turned into chaos, and there was infighting between Science Magazine and NASA, and the scientists had a mad scramble to get to Washington for the press conference. David McKay, the leader of the group, had gone AWOL and was on a camping trip with his family in the hills of West Texas, and they almost couldn't find him. He just happened to call in on a telephone from a general store and was told, "Get yourself to Washington right away. The news is broke. You're up." And so there was a press conference the next day after the news had been in all the headlines around the world and already created a big fuss. And President Clinton made a statement in the Rose Garden. And there were international headlines and TV. And the word was out. And then began a big controversy.
Hmm. Now, some critics charge that NASA hyped this, but it sounds, the way you tell the story, that really the manner of the reveal really dictated how things went from there.
Well, I think the fact that the news leaked out early contributed to some of the hostility afterward, because a lot of scientists, like a lot of other people, members of Congress and other VIPs and others, were caught off guard by the news. But there was also another component, and the book goes back in time to examine this, and that's NASA's history and reputation,
mm-hmm.
Its approach to handling science. NASA was compromised as a scientific agency by the way it was established during the Cold War. Congress intended it to perform seemingly impossible acts on an international stage and show that American technology was superior and dazzle us all. And as part of that, it sometimes compromised its approach to science. It spread the wealth among congressional districts and pioneered the non-competitive contract, and as one historian put it, refused to go along with the old concept that scientific merit was the only determinant of who got a grant. And so NASA's own DNA, to some extent, put it at odds with the scientific establishment.
Yeah. And also,
but it wasn't justified in this case, in my view. In my view, in this case, they did things right, or tried to, most of the time.
Yeah, yeah. And also, we have to think about the 80s. We've got 84, the rock is collected. 86, the Challenger tragedy.
Absolutely, yes. NASA had been having all sorts of problems, and there had also been a big trouble with a flaw built into the Hubble Space Telescope when it was launched, and NASA had really fallen on hard times budget-wise and otherwise, at the time this became public, the news about the rock.
Has NASA done a good deal of soul searching now, and where do things stand, do you suppose, within that culture? Are things better?
Well, I covered NASA for about 17 years for the Post, and I know that they're subject to many conflicting pressures from Congress, from the White House, and then, of course, they've had trouble with being asked to do all these very advanced or difficult technical things while pleasing various political constituencies, and yet without a predictable amount of money in their budget. And so that said, still, they've had a tendency to exaggerate or drum up scientific justification for some of the things they've been asked to do or have proposed to do. One of the notable examples of this is the International Space Station, and another is their efforts to make it sound as though John Glenn's flight aboard the shuttle was really justified by science, when many people questioned that. And so it's not a simple picture, but the leadership, past and present, has struggled with these realities, and I know that the current administrator, Dr. Griffin, has said all the right things and is working very hard and has commissioned some teams of people to correct some of the especially more recent problems with their handling of public information and the so-called the marketing, if you will, of science.
One of the interesting stories you tell in the book is really kind of a political sidebar, and it involves the resignation of a top Clinton advisor. You want to tell us the story?
Well, yes. This is this gives me one of the few spicy bits in this book. It's in a nutshell. President Clinton's trusted advisor, Dick Morris, a married man, had been seeing a call girl and letting her listen in on his private conversations with the president. And, of course, along the way, Morris whispered to her about this hush-hush secret news about possible life on Mars. Well, she, meanwhile, was trying to sell her story to a tabloid, and she tried to use the rock as proof of her credibility, that she was really on the inside. She got things a little bit confused, and she wrote in her diary at one point, "They've discovered life on Pluto." Well, that was not right. But in the end, the story of the rock gave her the leverage she needed, and she got her story published ultimately in a tabloid. And Dick Morris, the advisor, was forced to resign during the midst of the Democratic presidential nominating convention. And that was just one of the many ripple effects from this rock.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the principals now before we have to wrap up, the folks in this story. Robbie Score, David McKay, Duck Mittelfeld, Chris Romanoff. What's been the impact of this debate on these folks?
Well, Robbie Score stayed in touch with both the people and the evidence about the rock, and she actually, after she found the rock on her initial visit to Antarctica, she had been a curator of meteorites at NASA's Johnson Space Center, and then she went to Antarctica in 1984 and found this rock, and she fell in love with Antarctica, and basically she became a scientist based much of the year in Antarctica, and spent much of her life subsequently there at the bottom of the world. And then a few years ago, she had a ridge named after her, in part, well, mainly because of her discovery of this incredible rock. And David McKay he's still working on this line of inquiry. He's still trying to prove what he deeply believes to be the case, which is that there is evidence of life on early Mars in this rock. He's working on this rock. He and Everett Gibson and the others in Houston are working on other rocks from Mars, and they are expecting to publish some more work. But they've also been under fairly harsh attack from colleagues, other scientists who think they've become overly committed, shall we say, to this story and have pursued it beyond where they should have. And they of course, take issue with that. But in short, the controversy continues at a somewhat reduced level, and they continue to turn out papers. And then other people have moved on entirely. A prominent scientist from Stanford, Richard Zayer, contributed quite a bit to the initial paper on the rock, and he has really moved on. He's still interested in the story, but he's moved on to other things. And Chris Romanek, likewise, he keeps in touch, but has moved on to other things. But they all consider this one of the life-changing events.
Hmm. One more person I want you to talk about before we run out of time. Andrew Steele.
Ah, Steely is his nickname.
Okay.
He is a microbiologist who was in England when he heard the headlines, heard the BBC broadcast that about the possible signs of early life on Mars in this rock, and he was so taken by the idea that he first got a sample from David McKay to work on it. He traveled to Houston and presented his paper at one of the first meetings ever held to discuss the rock and the evidence, and he ended up, in short, changing his life, uprooting his family, moving to this country. And he's done some really groundbreaking work in which he actually found life in this Martian meteorite, even after people with the best instruments and expertise had pronounced it devoid of all life. Andrew Steele, found astounding evidence that the rock was crawling with Earth microbes, and he's written a number of papers about this, and this has led to ideas and devices that are being produced for future missions to Mars that would help sort out these various difficult distinctions between what's from Earth, what's from Mars, which kind of contamination is it, and then secondly, what's merely non-biological chemistry, and then what are the signs of biology? How do you recognize biology when you see it at tiny microscopic level?
Yeah. Do you think we'll see in the near future a big story break? Are there breakthroughs on the horizon? Do you think the public will get excited again like 1996?
I think if there's a consensus among all the conflicting parties on this subject, it is that the real answers will be found on Mars. And a lot of the people who are at odds about the Martian meteorite are working in concert to improve understanding of these issues, how you define life, how you recognize what's Martian and what's from Earth, and so on, to make sure that when they do get some samples from Mars that seem to indicate signs of life, they don't have the same troubles that have arisen over this one sample that was sent to us randomly by Nature.
We need more information.
We need more information, and as they would say, more funding.
Well, as we say in the radio business, stay tuned. Kathy, thank you for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you, Celeste.
Kathy Sawyer has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She is the author of The Rock from Mars, a detective story on two planets. The book is published by Random House. It's 9 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. Settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Dave Dickey.
Thank you very much, Celeste, and good afternoon, everyone. Well, it was a higher day in both soybeans and corn today. While the wheat pit set back some, all ahead of tomorrow's USDA supply and demand estimate reports coming out at 7:30 in the morning. Just a reminder, shortly after those reports are out, you can go to our website at WILLAG.org and get the latest on those reports. And if you're a subscriber of our Ag e-letter, you'll be able to receive those that way as well. If you're not a subscriber, you can sign up today. Why not do it today at WILLAG.org? Let's go ahead and look at the settlements. March wheat in Kansas City, a high on the day of 440, a low of 436, settling 439, unchanged on the day. May, a high of 446.5, a low of 439.5, settling 443.75, up a quarter. March wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade, the big loser on the day in terms of cents, a high on the day of 377, a low of 370, settling 370.75, down 5.25. May, a high of 387.5, a low of 378.5, settling 381, down 3.5. July, a high of 398, a low of 390, settling 393.25, down 2.5. September, a high of 407.5, a low of $4.50, settling 403, down 2.75. December, a high of 420, a low of 413, settling 415.5, down 3. March, a high of 428, a low of 422.5, settling 424.5, down 2.5 on the day. March corn, a high of 223.5, excuse me, a low of 220, settling 223.25, up 4.25. The May contract, a high of 232.5, a low of 229, settling 232, up 4. July, a high of 242.75, a low of 239.25, settling 242.25, up 4. September, a high of 251, a low of 248.25. Settling 250.5, up 3.75. December, a high of 261.5, a low of 257.5, settling 260.75, up 4. March, a high of 268.75, a low of 265.25, settling 268, up 4.5. May, a high of 272, a low of 269, settling 272, up 4.25. Of course, the trade expecting that on tomorrow's reports, USDA will make some adjustment to corn export numbers. March oats, a high of 181, a low of 180.5, settling on its low, up a quarter on the day. May, a high of 185.5, a low of 181, settling 185, down 1.25. March beans, a high of 577, a low of 574, settling 576.5, up 4.25. May, a high of 589.5, a low of 585, settling 587.75, up 3.75. July, a high of $6.75, a low of 597, settling 599.75, up 3.75. August, a high of 604.5, a low of 601.5, settling at its high, up 5.25 on the day. September, a high of 607, a low of 605.5, settling 605, up 3.5. November, a high of 614.5, a low of 611, settling 614.25, up 4.5. January, a high of 620, a low of 616.5, settling 619.5, up 3.75. March soybean meal, a high of 172.90, a low of 171.70, settling 172.50, up 70 cents. May, a high of 174.60, a low of 173.30, settling 173.90, up 50. March soybean oil, a high of 23.85, a low of 23.67, settling 23.75, up 16. The May, a high of 24.18, a low of 23.98, settling 24.07, up 15 on the day. We'll have settlement prices from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange in just a moment.
In fact, we'll have them right now. Another lower day today on the Merck for livestock contracts. March feeder cattle, the high today 104.20, the low 103.50, the settlement 103.55, that down 45. April 105.70, the high 104.50, the low 104.62.5, the settlement that down 50. May 106.80, the high 105.65, the low 105.77.5, the settlement that finishing off 45 cents. April live cattle 84.95, the high 83.90, the low 83.97.5, the settlement that down 17.5. June live cattle 79.85, the high 78.85, the low 79.40, the settlement that up a nickel. April lean hogs 59.40, the high 58.60, the low 58.65, the settlement that down 50. May, today's high 66.70, the low 66.20, the settlement 66.55, that down 15. June 68.20, the high 67.60, the low, the settlement 67.85, that down 45. July 67.40, the high 66.80, the low, the settlement 66.97.5, that down 35. And March bellies 85.80, today's high, the low 84.90, the settlement 85.75, that down 145. The Dow is off 20 points at 10,986. The NASDAQ down 9 points at 2258. And the S&P 500 is off 3 at 1275.
Today's programming is made possible in part by Ratio Architects, dedicated to enhancing the local Champaign community, on the web at ratioarchitects.com.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 85 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partner, AgriFab Incorporated, Sullivan, Dick's Pharmacy, Arthur, and EAGCO Incorporated in Fairmount. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you. You're tuned to WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. You'll find us online at WILL.